Welcome to Coach to Scale, how modern leaders build coaching cultures. I'm your host, Matt Benelli. Join me as we build a community of like-minded professionals who share the belief that effective coaching improves the performance of every team member. Our mission is to help leaders become better coaches. The Coach to Scale podcast is sponsored by Coachem, the world's first AI coaching execution platform that leverages evidence-based coaching to increase quota attainment. And with that, let's get started. Hi, everybody. Over the past 12 weeks here in Q1 of 2024, I've had the pleasure of interviewing some top-notch sales leaders, as well as prolific authors, researchers, and professors who care deeply about the profession of sales and sales leadership. This episode of Coach to Scale is a montage of the first 12 interviews of the year. So get comfortable and grab a pen to take some notes as you listen to these folks identify and debunk some very common myths that persist in the world of sales. Let's kick it off by allowing Brent Adamson of Challenger fame to address what is by far the most common myth when it comes to coaching salespeople. I can't imagine anybody has more data on this topic than Brent. Hear him talk about the trade-offs that need to be made in order to make time for the most important things in our lives.
I imagine you've heard this a lot because we all hear this about coaching. There's just not enough time. Should we start there? Because that feels like the number one thing that I've, you know, back at corporate executive board, CEB back in the day. And so this is all pre-Challenger 2004 to 2007. We got on a pretty deep run of research around sales coaching and really changed some minds and had a huge impact. And then we all kind of lost the thread, which is unfortunate because here we are, what, 20 years later almost, and now we're all kind of back to square one. But that was certainly back then at least. And I'd love to just get your thoughts on this. I imagine you're hearing this today. It's like, we know it's important. We've got so many other meetings, so much things to do, and we just don't have time.
For the past over 10 years, 11 years, myself, my partners, we've gone around the world training B2B sales organizations, coaching, consulting leaders. And one of the questions we always ask is two questions. What do you want to do more of? It's coaching, supervising, training, mentoring. It's in a context. What do you want to do more of? And then why don't you do it? And the answer always is, I want to do more coaching. Why don't you? I don't have time. And that's almost 90% of responses fall into that category.
You know, so here's why I think it's a myth is one is, not to get too personal because nobody cares, right? But the I've been on, and I'm on my second one now in my middle ages, a weight loss journey, right? And just things got a little away from me there for a while, right? So. And it's funny, if you look at my weight chart, it spikes way up and it goes way down and it bounces around and it goes way back up and I'm trying to drive it back down again. And the only reason I'm talking about any of this, because nobody, like I said, nobody cares, is that I need to exercise more. I need to think about my diet. I need to plan my meals. But who's got time for that? And what you ultimately, there's two points to this myth. Here's the first point. The first point is, at some point when you wake up and decide to commit to whatever it is you're going to commit to, whether it's coaching, weight loss, whatever it is, knitting, but you make the time. You find some way to force the time and you do the hard trade-offs. Now, that comes from a slightly, position of privilege. But for most professionals, I think that's true, at least when it comes to coaching, is that, life is about trade-offs, as we all know, not to tell people what they already live every single day. And those trade-offs are hard. I tell people about weight loss, same thing I tell people about coaching. Every single day is a decision. And every single day, you've got to remake that decision. You've got to make that decision, that hard decision to say, I'm going to focus on this at the expense of something else. And there's going to be costs for that, whether it's something doesn't get done or I get in trouble or whatever. And sometimes that's really hard math. And sometimes you have to forgive yourself and give yourself the grace to know that that's not always going to be the case. You can't always make that decision. So that's at a personal level. But at an organizational level, I think here's where, this is where it really, this point about time really came from. Back in the day, as I mentioned, in the early 2000s, we profiled a case at the time. It was from Novartis, the pharmaceutical company. They decided for a number of different reasons, they were going to double down on coaching. They were going to spend a lot of time, money, and effort on getting coaching right. And so they did exactly what you've done, is they went out and talked to their managers and everyone said, we'd love to coach. We just don't have time. So their conclusion was, wow, we have a capacity problem. We have a time problem. So number one solution is, we are going to clear the decks. We're going to kill all the meetings. Not all of them. We're going to kill many meetings. We're going to free up time. So before they even got started, they took a survey of their sales reps around the quality of, and the quantity of coaching that they're receiving. The scores were like through the floor, right? It's like, we're not getting coaching. It's a low quality coaching. There's basically, the overall score for coaching was very, very low. So they go through a months long process of freeing up time, freeing up capacity, and emphasizing it, telling your managers it's important. So they solve the time problem. Then they go out and resurvey their sales reps. And you know how much the coaching scores from the sales reps went up? Absolutely not at all. So, right? There's just because I've got more time to coach doesn't mean that I'm going to be any better as a coach, right? That at the end of the day, what really we need to focus on is not so much, do I spend 2 hours a week or 3 hours a week? I'm so confused. It's rather, what the heck should I even be doing in the first place that constitutes good coaching? And if I understand that, I'll find the time. I'll make the time. I'll make that hard decision. It's just so easy to fall back on, you know, I'm not losing weight because I don't have time to go to the gym, or I don't have time to think about diet, or I'm not coaching because I don't have time because I'm stuck in meetings. And it's rarely the underlying problem.
Now, Brent's one of the best in the business, and he's reminding us to dig further to treat the underlying root cause of the problem, not just the symptom or surface pain. Another myth we hear a lot is that it's not in his or her DNA. This insinuates that the best leaders are born, not made. What does Lori Harmon over at Cloudflare think about that?
I would say one of the myths that I hear a lot is that good salespeople are born, not made. And certainly everybody's born with certain qualities and characteristics. You know, if you look at some of the evaluations on people's personas, you might get something like, you're a driver, you're an introvert, or you're extrovert. So those things do play a role. And certainly some people might, or some personalities might lend themselves more to being a seller. But I don't think it's something that you can have an interview with somebody and your gut tells you that they're going to be a good salesperson, because people can learn and people can be trained. And certainly during my career, I've met people that you might not look at or meet for the first time and think, oh, wow, they'd be an amazing salesperson. Yet with the proper training and coaching and their drive, they become great salespeople. And so I do think salespeople can be made if that's their passion and that's a direction they want to go. And you have to be careful as a leader just going with your gut. You certainly need to be hiring people with a very structured hiring framework so you make sure that you're getting the right talent.
You know, I was interviewing Brent Adamson recently, and he said something like that, that kind of ties into what you're saying that I found interesting, which, you know, he talked about, hey, you know, we can talk about A players, B players, and C players using those terms. And he said, what's important about how you work and manage with the C players is you as a leader have to show up and be prepared. You approach it in a different way, but the other person's got to be willing to do the work, right? They have to, it's a two-way street. You can't give up on them if they're doing the work. And it's really important. I think that ties back to, they're not born, they're made. You have an obligation as a leader to help make them if they want to be made, if that makes sense.
And that's a really good point, because if you look at a seller, when you first hire them, you know, they're not going to close something day two. There's a ramp here. So how do you know as a leader if they are like on track to get there, right? So they have to demonstrate certain things that are not closing deals. Maybe that's activities. Maybe that's pipeline build. Maybe that's number of meetings. Whatever it is for your individual company, you do have to understand, A, are they on track? So they're showing a desire to be successful and doing the right things, even if they're not yet having the right outcomes. So that's a great point. I love it. And Brent's a great guy. I happen to know Brent. So there you go.
So it doesn't matter if you're introverted or you're extroverted. What matters is that you put the work in. Another common myth heard so many times we start believing it is that managers should hire people on their team that are just like them. Christina Schmears over at MongoDB tells us why this may not be the best idea.
One of the myths that I think I actually believed in when I was sort of younger in my career, and still see it play out today, but know it's not true, is the myth that you should hire more of you. So if you're really good, especially in sales, if you're a really good sales professional, and you have the criteria to be successful, go replicate yourself. Go hire 12 of you. I actually had a leader once that said, oh, we're putting you in a leadership position because we want 7 more of you. And I was like, actually, that's not what actually makes winning teams. And by the way, that also isn't real life or doesn't scale. So in my opinion, I think the best teams are where I hire people that are different than me in skill set and background and strengths, frankly. And that's how you create an amazing team, that sum of the parts is better than the individual. So I think that's one is don't hire replicas of yourself, because I don't think that's a real thing.
I love what you said there, that, hey, you believed it for a while, right? So some of these myths, I think I act like, oh, I never believed that. But we did. We did for many, many years. And then it's like, oh, maybe it's not exactly that way.
Yeah. Right? And then someone opens your eyes, usually. You hire someone that's different than you, or you work with someone that's different than you and thinks different and processes information. My best example is I had a guy on my team. I'm a list person. So I would give them the list of everything that we needed to accomplish. And he took it and he made the list a calendar by date and did it like almost like a timeline and milestone. It's a small thing, but the way he processed information, I was like, actually, same end result, maybe even better. And you just process it differently. That's actually really eye-opening for me. So that was number one. Number two, and this is specific to sales. So for your listeners that are in sales or sales leadership, which I imagine is a lot because you're a bit of a sales legacy yourself, is that you have to be extroverted to be in sales. And that is a big myth in my mind. I think some of the best salespeople are introverts and process information and are really good listeners. Both can excel. And by the way, you need both on a team. But I think that's a myth because introverts can get the most out of customers. They're really good listeners. They process information differently. They're more thoughtful. And you kind of need an introvert to balance out an extrovert like me, for example, in a team meeting, so that you get the best of both worlds.
It's easy to fall for this one. After all, we're so good and we're promoted. Why wouldn't we hire others just like us? Well, I'd listen to Christina and take Public Enemy's advice on this. Don't believe the hype. Next up, Channing Ferrer puts a controversial spin on where managers should be spending their time. And it's not what you've been told.
There's a myth or a theory or a philosophy, some might even say, around where sales managers should spend their time. And a lot of coaching books out there say, focus on the mid-tier of your team. You know, spend time coaching there. Don't spend time on the bottom tier because they're just going to fail. And the top tier are kind of hard to coach. You might be able to make them a little better, spend a little time there, but really focus in on that middle tier. And often they talk about it in an alphabet grade. You have your A, your B, your C, your D kind of players, which means, you know, don't spend time in the D. I think my contrarian view is actually do spend some time on the D. But the reason I think it's so important to spend time on the D is because you need to make decisions with those D groupings. I see way too many sales managers, especially managers that are relatively new to their role, not making the hard decisions, not pushing people in the right direction. And therefore, that D player lingers. And it might not be a metrics-driven performance plan organization, or it might be they're just kind of on the cusp of that metric that says they have to be managed out or they don't. And they're kind of dragging down the overall aggregate, but they're still lingering around. You have to spend time figuring out, am I going to get them to be better? Am I going to be able to invest in this person? Or if not, I've got to push them out of the business and go through a PIP and the process and so on. But if you don't spend some time there, you can't make that decision and you can't either elevate or push out maybe. So I do think it's really important actually to spend the time to make those decisions. It's too easy to let people linger and struggle a bit and barely get by. They're not happy. You're not happy. You know, it doesn't lead down a healthy path overall. So that's a little bit of my myth is, again, people say, don't spend time on those D players. I actually say, do spend time, but make decisions when you spend that time.
Yeah, our most precious commodity certainly is our time. But when we have folks on the bubble, those D players, decisions need to be made. The D is for decision. Pull them up or move them out. Up next, Steve Goldberg at SalesLoft addresses two common sales myths. The first, that salespeople are meat-eating animals who only care about closing deals. And the second, that your initial success means you can rest on your laurels. Let's listen to Steve.
When I first started selling, being a salesperson had a pretty negative connotation on it, like when I was growing up. Yeah. And when I was growing up, I like didn't want to admit that I was a salesperson. When people asked me what I did, I tried to like talk around it. But at the end of the day, what I realized, what salespeople are is they're problem solvers. And you know, they help your customers solve their own problems, but not only professionally, but personally too, because you know, some of the best relationships that I have in my career, and I'm fortunate enough to be re-engaging with a lot of people I've worked with across sales, in any place I've ever worked, is that if you help customers solve problems and you're with them in the good times and the tough times, you know, those are relationships you have for life. And what's great to see is when you help a customer navigate around a problem and see them get promoted and see them get the benefits and see them grow their career. And, you know, it's just, to me, it's a myth that you're just trying to close a deal, that you're going to drive by a customer at 65 miles per hour and throw software over to them and then go on to the next one. And I think that's a myth. And then I also strongly believe that there's such a change going on in the market that you have to realize, like, what got you there at one point of your career doesn't necessarily get you there at another part of your career. And you have to really, truly have a growth mindset every step of the way. To mean, like, you may have done things one way in the past, but a lot's changed in the market. A lot's changed in the macro economy. A lot's changed in, you know, the way people think about things, the way people buy. And you've got to have a growth mindset. And when you get coached, you've got to want to learn. You've got to want to take the information and do something about it. You know, there's so many people that coach just to check a box and say, I was coached, but they don't consume it. They don't try things and they don't take it and they don't learn from it. They don't study. They don't train. Just like an athlete, like, you're going to show up at a game, you may get lucky once, but if you're not, you don't have the endurance, if you don't have the practice, it's hard to get lucky twice.
So Steve, when you talk about growth mindset, for many years, espoused the work that Carol Dweck did with her book, Growth Mindset, and there's the fixed mindset, there's the growth mindset. What does growth mindset mean to you? And can you maybe share an example with someone who's heard the term, but maybe doesn't even know specifically what it means in the context of how we're talking about it today?
Yeah, I would say, like, a fixed mindset is like, I did this one way and this is how I'm going to do it. This is what I'm going to do. My mind's already made up. Like, there's a concept of listening for, and there's a concept of listening against. So you could be talking to me, but I'm listening against what you said, because my mind's already made up. I'm going to go down this path. I don't care. I might be showing you I'm listening to you, but I'm already going down this other path. So I'll show you that I'm listening to you, but I'm not really taking it in, because I'm already set that this is the right way to do it. And a growth mindset is like, you're naturally curious. You want to learn. You want to consume. You're willing to try new things. Like, you're willing to consume information and do something about it. And I call that listening for versus listening against.
I think we can all agree the problem solving, start over. I think we can all agree that problem solving and the growth mindset go hand in hand, and that it's far more effective to listen for versus listen against. And my wife would certainly upvote that too. Our next guest, Ben Kennedy from Alation, tackles a myth that many of us grew up with in this business, much to the dismay of our VC and private equity friends. Now, I'm talking about the myth that you can hire your way to revenue growth, meaning that the more people equals the more revenue.
One of the things I'm a believer in, and I think is a current myth, is that sales is a formulaic process by which if you add sales capacity, you're going to add revenue. Simply put, more sellers equals more revenue. And in today's world, I think that's a myth. I think you really have to think about the quality of the people you're bringing on board, the addressable market you're going after, or the ICP, the ideal customer profile, and be thoughtful and intentional about how you build a sales organization. I've been a part of sales organizations. We follow that model. If we hire more, we'll sell more. And I've seen it backfire. And conversely, I've been in roles where we've kept the team small and tight, and we've been more productive because we've been more intentional about our outreach. So that's one myth I think modern sales leaders need to think about. Is adding capacity really going to add revenue? Or have you done the homework to identify your ideal customer profile and your addressable market?
So it's like the old days. It was just, you know, call as many people, throw a bunch of stuff against the wall and see what sticks. The modern day version of that is just keep hiring people and, you know, the great results will follow. I love the words you used, you know, about thoughtful and intentional. What are some of the negative consequences of just hiring more people and expecting the revenue is not going to come?
Yeah. So in my experience, when you overhire, the probability of the percentage of people on your team hitting quota decreases. So what happens is you overhire because typically, no offense, but typically someone in finance says, hey, we add capacity means we add revenue. So you're squeezing more sellers into the same TAM if you haven't added product or grown your TAM by some meaningful amount. And so the negative consequences are you have more people, but fewer people are making quota. That leads to higher attrition, longer ramping time for the team you have. And when with your current sellers, they're probably looking at their territories thinking, hey, if the model the company's going after is to continually squeeze my territory, what is the future going to hold for me? And you see some companies out there today, they're successful companies, to be fair, but they've gone from maybe a seller has three or four accounts to then they had one account. Now they have one account, but there's three, four, five sellers on that account. And look, some companies can make that work. And depending on the scale of your products in your company's portfolio or the market you're going after, that might be appropriate. So I'm not knocking the model. But I think you really have to be, to your point, intentional about how we're adding capacity to a sales model to make sure it's not just adding capacity for capacity's sake, because the risk is you're going to have fewer people making their number, which leads to higher attrition. And one of the most expensive parts of a sales leadership role is that attrition, voluntary or involuntary.
Throwing headcount at a problem doesn't always solve it. Sometimes it makes it worse. Ben does a great job pointing that out, and that bad morale and few salespeople hitting quota leads to a revolving door of talent, the death knell of any sales team. Dr. Howard Dover from the University of Texas at Dallas is our next sales myth buster. And he caught me off guard with his answer to my question regarding common myths in sales. Check it out.
We should scale best practices.
Scale best practices. So why is that a myth?
In all myth busting, there's half truth, right? There's a truth to it, but there's also in the implementation, there's the challenge and where the myth gets created. It's not that I'm against best practices. We have to train people, right? I mean, you have to, chaos doesn't generate revenue. When you're lucky, it does. But, you know, just go to a casino and then, but even that's strategically designed, right? But a lot of what we do in sales is tactical best practice, right? I see something, it works, therefore I'm going to codify it. I'm going to create a structure around it. I'm going to train for it. I'm going to deploy it. It's going to be the way we do business here. And the reason this is a challenge for us is the fact that most of this concept of best practice and scaling is coming from the manufacturing sector, right? This idea that we can get efficiencies through consistency and repetition and scaling. The challenge in sales is that we're working with two pieces of information which are not static. The first one being the salesperson themselves. Salesperson is a human that makes decisions. And then we're interacting with a buyer or buyers, usually it's buyers, plural, that also are human beings with choice. And so when we then start trying to scale a process to take an individual through, we have a lot of variableness. We have a variable with the human who we're trying to teach to do what we're scaling to. And then we also have the person who's receiving that process. So really we have to look back and say, well, is this tactical? Is it tactical to achieve an objective? And a lot of what we've seen over the last probably decade or so have been tactical hacks, right? We like hacking things. Hey, I hacked this, I hacked that, I hacked that. Well, you know, if you take that word and you throw it over to the customer and say, how do you like being hacked? They're going, well, I quit hacking me. And so actually, when we look at the Gartner research and say the rep-free experience that the buyer is requesting, it used to be 60%. I think it's now above 70 or closing in on 80% of buyers say, I prefer a rep-free experience. I think that means quit hacking me. The hacking isn't giving me any value.
Now, Dr. Dover is someone we can all learn from. Check out his book, The Sales Innovation Paradox. If you've ever wondered why your company has invested tons of dough into sales tools, but performance and profitability have gone in the wrong direction, you might have to ask yourself, what's going on? Next up is someone who is pissed about what Dr. Dover calls the sales innovation paradox. Justin Ottley from Talkdesk goes for the jugular when addressing another common myth to which many sales leaders fall prey. Take a listen.
I might just go for the jugular on this one.
Do it, man. Do it. Don't wimp out.
There's definitely a really hot topic for me right now, and it is the SDR, the sales tech stack, right? What you need and what you don't need. And the hot topic for me in particular is definitely sales engagement platforms. I'm getting to the point where, you know, I've evaluated just about every single one of them. I've tried a lot of them and they're all pissing me off more and more because none of them are actually mastering one particular thing, one particular piece of the process. It's this all-encompassing platform trying to do everything, but not doing any one particular thing that great or that good.
So Justin, just for the audience, when you say sales engagement platform, we're not trying to throw any companies under the bus here, but like, just can you describe what you mean when you say sales engagement platform, just to level set before you go into it?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. It's that central place where you are managing for like an SDR team or from a marketing sales team where you're managing your cadences, your sequences that are going to be automated and sent out to your target market, right? That could be a series of emails, LinkedIn calls, you know, it's a way to organize it all together. So I was actually using Outreach since like, I think 2017 up until about 2023 or something like that. And it did what I needed it to do. But the problem with a lot of these different, and this isn't me attacking Outreach, because now there's all these up and coming companies that are trying to take Outreach and SalesLoft's lunch, where they've got some really good marketing, but then when you actually start to play with the platform, they're missing out on a lot, right? And so where I'm getting at with a myth is that, look, you don't need the best tech stack. You don't need the most state-of-the-art tech stack. What's far, far, far more important and far more proven right now is the fundamentals. Right. I think as a company, as a team, as a leadership team, if you invest first in helping your sellers, your SDRs master their fundamentals, that is going to drive way more results than any engagement platform, than any tech stack can. Because here's the problem. If you're not investing in your team's coaching and training the right way, and you go bring on this tech stack to try to automate everything, it's not going to fix everything because it's on a broken foundation.
Technology certainly has its place, but it's nothing without talented people executing the sales fundamentals consistently. To think technology is the be-all, end-all is a sucker's bet. What do we have to do to ensure that we don't get fooled again? Next up, Mark Abode talks about the folly of trying to manage the results and manipulating the scoreboard instead of focusing on the behaviors and playing the next play. Let's listen.
I would say I've always focused on what I think is the right thing to do. So I haven't worried about too much about myths and other things that other people do. It's kind of play your own game, right? But for me, you know, the big aha is a lot of people manage the numbers and then manage a forecast as sales leaders. And that's not really what you're managing. You're managing people, you're managing behaviors, you're managing your culture. That's going to get you the outcomes, not looking at the scorecard. I think that's the biggest flaw that some sales leaders might have, or new sales leaders.
So too many sales leaders, whether they believe they have to or not, like they feel compelled to focus on the result. We got to close the deal. We got to hit the number. Those are the outcomes. Those are the results. What you've built a career on is focusing on behaviors, right? Focusing on playing the next play. Was there a watershed moment, Mark? Was there, like, when did you first recognize that focusing on the behaviors was the right way to go, despite all the pressure that's out there?
Well, I would say, you know, when I joined Oracle Direct with you, Matt, back in the day, I had left running Canada for Oracle, and I probably ran Canada for Oracle in a fairly traditional way. You know, here's the forecast, here's the quarterly forecast, here are the deals, run the deals. And hey, nothing wrong with that. It's good to learn. But when I got to Oracle Direct, the scale was so enormous, 1,500 people, tens of thousands of deals. You can't manage your way to an outcome deal by deal because there's too many deals. So you're really forced into managing behaviors. And so as you look at managing behaviors and what are people doing and how are they doing and helping them learn and develop, you realize that actually is where the game is. The game's not on the forecast sheet. The game's not on the result at the end of the quarter. I mean, as salespeople, as sales leaders, of course we have a number, and of course we have to meet or exceed that number. But the question becomes, how do you do that consistently? And it's not looking at the forecast sheet. It's talking to the people about what they're doing every day.
Yeah, and Mark's so spot on. Businesses don't scale through deals. They typically scale with solid people doing more of the right things at the right time more often. It takes time and requires some patience for sure, which is really, really tough. Kevin Martin at Parchment addresses the myth that a sales leader has to be able to play at the same level as his or her salespeople, and that the best salespeople will automatically be the best sales leaders. Let's listen to Kevin.
There are two that come to mind. They're kind of one and the same a little bit, but two strands to think about. The first I think about is it applies to most like player coach dynamics, and that's that you have to have done the job or be able to still do the job in order to be good or great as a coach. Matt, we were just kind of joking about sports at the beginning of our conversation and hockey. And I mean, you could pick any sport, right? You could pick being a musician and a conductor, any of those things. Just because you are the conductor or the coach doesn't mean that you have to still be able to play or ever play it at the level that your teammates, your athletes are playing. And so I think that's a thing that people often miss when it comes to sales and sales management and sales coaching. To be a great coach, you have to know what your team is responsible for producing and recognize that your success is predicated wholly on their success. Then you throw yourself into working with each of them to get better at their craft. You aren't out on the ice, if you will. You aren't on the court. You're not in the band pit. They're showing them how to play their instrument. You're coaching them how to do that. The second myth, again, and that's kind of connected to the first, would be that great sales reps make great sales leaders. From time to time, you see, and I'm sure that you've seen this, Matt, I certainly have, and probably those that are listening to this have, you'll see great sales reps move into the sales leader position solely because they are great at attaining or exceeding quota, not because they've demonstrated any leadership qualities to lead a sales team or a team generally. This could be perceived as hurtful, but I don't intend it to be. In my experience, some of the greatest salespeople are often the most selfish people that I know, whereas the greatest sales leaders are the most selfless people that I know. And you can make that leap. Like, don't get me wrong, you can make the leap from salesperson to sales leader. But to do that, you've really got to learn to be selfless and think about the success of others as opposed to the success of yourself. Those would be the two myths that come to mind.
Love that. Being selfish versus selfless. The qualities and attributes for the best salespeople aren't directly correlated with those of the best sales leaders. To all of you sales leaders out there, it may be helpful to remember it's not about you. It's about the team. You'll achieve success through the work of others. Coming up next is Mike DeLoya, who heads up sales at Quid. Now, Mike is not a big fan of the one-size-fits-all approach to prospecting and thinks it's an ill-advised myth. Take a listen.
That's a good question. There's a lot of things that I look at. You mentioned against the grain. I consider myself a non-traditional sales leader in way. I do believe that process is very important, but I believe there's a myth out there that the process constantly has to be consistent. I believe you can actually adapt processes based on the situation you're in. And you don't have to have the same process in an organization for every part of the business. You can have one process for enterprise sales, one for commercial sales. It's okay. And you can adapt those processes as things change out there in the market. But there is a big myth that there's a magic process, there's magic metrics, et cetera, that you always follow and hit those numbers. And it's just something I haven't subscribed to in a long time since my initial foray into sales, where, you know, I was told make 100 calls a day, 3 hours of talk time, and you'll hit your numbers. And it was all about getting to those metrics and never hitting those numbers. And it was just a false way of getting to the outcomes.
Yeah. Arthur Red Motley said what was considered at the time the 13 greatest words in sales: know your products, know your customers, call them incessantly and ask them to buy. You know, it's like, okay, times have changed. Why do you think that myth persists? Why do you think that many people believe that there's this magic process and it's one size fits all?
I think it's because there's a lot of old school thinking out there. you know, technology has changed. You know, we're doing an online podcast right now, for example. You know, the way you have to reach a candidate, a prospect, could be through multiple factors, through LinkedIn, through YouTube videos. I've had SDRs send TikToks, for example. There's no magic, you know, prescription to it. Like, you can't just pick up the phone and hammer it anymore. If you're trying to get a hold of me, any SDRs out there that are trying to get a hold of me, you might not want to call me. But if you do, leave a voicemail. You know how many SDRs don't leave a voicemail? I'm going to listen to that voicemail, and then I'm probably going to have you talk to somebody else. But keep trying new things.
As Mike says, there's no one way to approach it. All right, everybody, let's put a bow on this. You've just heard some of the best B2B tech sales leaders in the business, along with some prolific authors, researchers, and professors, identify and debunk some deeply embedded myths in sales and sales leadership circles. It's a hard business. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. It's really hard. And to be successful, you have to train to become what John Hunter calls the corporate athlete. Why is B2B tech sales so challenging? What does it take to become the rock-solid corporate athlete that works and hits hard? Take a listen.
Let me answer that question. Let's put some context around it for everybody listening, you know, because in this particular talk, we're primarily talking to enterprise, SaaS companies, cybersecurity, automation, cloud, you name it, any domain. So I think the precursor to that question starts with the industry that we're in is the most competitive industry on the planet. If you found your way into this industry by accident, you may want to get out. This isn't for everybody. It starts with an industry that's moving so fast because of innovation, change, the currency, the value that's being born every single day. You just can't be of the faint of heart. You can't be slow. You can't want to coast. You can't want to be comfortable. You can't want to be safe. That this industry just doesn't allow it.
No safe spaces.
That's right. This is a radically changing, you know, dynamic industry that draws to it the best of the best to come in here. Because what do they want? They want wealth creation. They want to move fast. They don't want to sit in a cube for 30 years and push paper. They want to you know, really adapt. They want to be the resilient people who want to be in this industry because they think they're what I call corporate athletes. So setting that table, Matt, it requires the best of the best to be the most trained and strategic and the most thoughtful, mapped with that intense competitiveness, that ferocious get shit done attitude, the getting in early, the staying late. I mean, if you don't have those are table stakes. You won't make it a year in this industry if you aren't the hardest worker, if you're entitled, if you just want to, you're looking to work from home and leave at 4 and get jelly beans and free massages. It is going to be a short stint in this industry. COVID delayed it a little bit. It got a little funny in some of these companies, but in this industry, it's going to require this ability to work hard, hit hard, but also be strategic and plan and thoughtful. And that's where the myths set in. And with that comes learning and training and coaching in order to always get better. And a lot of times, if you're in this industry, Matt, and your heart rate's up and you're in war, and we're going to get acquired or we're not going to make the quarter or the month, what goes out the window? We go into fight or flight mode. John Hunter's calling you, Matt's calling you to offer you new tools. And what do? You say, hey guys, I have no time for you. I've got to keep my head down. You don't know what it's like to be me. I have to survive. You go into fight or flight mode. And that is where I see a lot of myths, a lot of avoidable mistakes. And the term I like to use is becoming half monk and half hitman. This ability to marry that awesome work ethic, low entitlement, get stuff done with strategic thinking, planning, breathing, influencing. And we combine those two in this industry. Those are the people that should be running the best companies.
Yeah. The B2B tech sales arena is the most demanding one on the planet because it's so competitive. And it's competitive because it attracts the best and it pays extraordinarily well if you're good at it. To survive and thrive, you have to become half hitman, half monk, as John says. I hope you've all enjoyed this Q1 2024 summary. I enjoyed every second of the guest interviews and I look forward to seeing what the next quarter brings. We have some great guests already lined up. So on behalf of Coachem and the Coach to Scale podcast, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And until next time, coach them if you want to keep them. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Coach to Scale, How Modern Leaders Build Coaching Cultures. For show notes and other episodes, visit us at coachem.io. That's coachem.io. And follow us on Twitter at Coachem Now. See you all next week. Thanks for joining. And remember, coach them if you want to keep them.